Welcome to another episode of Articulate Warbling with Laura and Zach. Here we go.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, lady boys, boy ladies, all of the other in-betweenies. Hello, and welcome to Articulate Warbling with me, Laura, and...
me, Zach.
Well done, you remembered your name.
I remembered my... It kind of came out really, really like... Zach!
He had to think really hard.
I did. I don't know why.
It is currently 20 to 9. Is it British summertime right now? Yeah, it must be.
Yeah, officially.
It is too damn hot to remember our own names.
No. And if you hear a robotic whirring and a bit of a pretend...
Well, that was a really good Chewbacca impression.
So if you hear this white noise in the background, just pretend it's a lot of machinery that enables us to record this, whereas that's not the truth. It's
actually in order to stop us from sweating profusely to the point that we melt into a puddle on the floor.
Well, like I said to Mum, I'm melting but without the butter, and she was like, I don't understand.
Good. Sorry,
You didn't understand either!
No, not at all. I was slightly distracted because I said, I text my mum. My mum's currently on holiday, and I text her and I said, we need cooking oil and you didn't put it on the shopping list. And she went, do you not remember the gigantic one you bought during lockdown? And I'm like,
Oh
yeah. So cut a long story short, I now need to go and find that at some point and refill the oil. Because she put olive oil on the list. So I messaged her, I was like, did you mean olive oil or do you mean cooking oil? And she's like, no, olive oil, because I'm having all these fancy beetroot salads. Anyway, so I was just like, oh, okay, we need cooking
oil.
You
need olive oil to make a beetroot salad nice?
Well, the thing is olive oil is meant to be for salads, because there was hype a little while ago about olive oil, cooking with olive oil causing, like, carcinogenic chemicals.
Really?
Yeah. So now people are advised, because it used to be like Jamie Oliver's, like, extra virgin olive oil. By the dump load.
Put it on your cup of tea.
But yeah, no. Basically, they're saying now that cooking olive oil is carcinogenic in some way or another. So we're on just a sunflower oil for our cooking oil.
But I thought sunflower oil has always been like the definitive oil.
Well, the funny thing is you use vegetable oil at home and we use sunflower. Mm. Mum always said to me, don't use vegetable oil. It tastes funny, like fishy.
What, you talking about my oil?
Yeah, but I cook with it all the time. It doesn't taste fishy.
No.
I think she's just having me on.
I think she is. Or she's just very biased with her taste when it comes to cooking oil. Anyway, welcome to Articulate Oiling.
No, warbling, darling, warbling.
But you've already introduced it. This is the special episode about cooking oil. I'm joking.
Yeah, I'm not sure I can make an hour's worth of episode about cooking oil. I've managed 3 minutes, but I don't think I can go much further.
So, the episode...
Yeah, so we're going to talk a little bit. We're going to talk a little bit about our first cinematic experience for 6 months.
Yeah.
And the film that we saw, which was Unhinged. And then we're going to go in a bit deep, actually, aren't we? We're going to go for.
Multiple facets of.
This is a real all sorts episode, isn't it?
It is, a real all sorts. Emotional sorts.
Yes, exactly. So then we're going to go in after watching something on Netflix, which is around dating people that are on the autism spectrum. So Zach thought it would be a really good idea to do a little Q&A or kind of interview type process, whereby he will ask me some questions about how it is to live with him, i.e. somebody with autism. And then I'm going to go on to talk about Denise Welch and her book, which is The Unwelcome Visitor. And then we'll both go into a bit more about mental health, how it's affected us, things around that.
I think that with the Denise Welch thing, aside from you having such a great experience reading it and reviewing it, again, it opens up topics of discussions that,
absolutely,
you know, any other given day, you know, entertainment wise podcast, which we try to do with the podcast, we want to entertain you, want to give you some insights, but we want to be quite transparent and open and, like, We're not the type of people who go, we're going to dedicate this whole episode to morbid black dog.
No, and actually I've just thought we're going to start it really really happy and really good, and I think actually we need to end it with something a bit more upbeat.
Yeah.
And something we haven't yet reviewed is Southpaw.
Yeah.
So I think we'll start with Unhinged and our cinematic experience, go into the deeper stuff, and then at the end a bit of a light-hearted review of Southpaw.
Sure.
Cool. Right, so let's get straight in there with our cinematic experience. First one for 6 months. Whoop, whoop.
Is it 6 months?
It has been 6 months. The last film we went to see was The Invisible Man, and that was in February. End of February, early March.
Oh my God, six months. No wonder I had such a tough time. We attempted to go the first day that the cinemas reopened.
Which was the 31st of July.
They relaunched it. Cinemas had been open in more bigger cities like London and bigger cinemas, but the one in our local vicinity, as big and vast as the cinemas are, they weren't opening because
a majority of them weren't. It was just just some of the biggest ones in London that were open.
And a lot of people faced criticism for that. I saw a couple of people were like, yeah, I went to the cinemas willy-nilly, and it's like, you need to stop making people feel guilty for wanting to go out.
Yeah, I mean, there's. I think the thing is, when it comes to stuff like this, yes, it's an entertainment, yes, it's a luxury, and yes, it is non-essential. However, if you go in knowing the rules, knowing that you still have to be cautious and careful around COVID and the symptoms and the social distancing, I don't think there's any problem in this.
No.
And something that I was watching, we were both watching actually, on a popular morning TV show, Jeremy Vine, if you would like to sponsor this podcast.
Well, I think Jeremy Vine hardly has any sponsors himself on Channel 5.
No, I don't think so. But, you know, he was talking a lot about whether pubs should stay open or whether schools, pubs should be closed in order for schools to open. And actually, I think this is similar with the cinema thing. If it's okay for people to go to pubs, I don't go to pubs personally, but if it's okay for people to go to pubs, I genuinely think it's okay, therefore, for people to go to cinemas.
Well,
this is the thing. If I don't go to a pub and that's somebody else's entertainment, why can't I go to my entertainment that's open? So actually, me going to the cinema is the same as every other bugger going to the pub to watch the football last week.
Yeah, exactly. It's at we live in a world now where eateries such as Wetherspoons, they get a lot of their money based upon cheap, easy grub, but alcohol.
Absolutely.
So because they're an eatery, of course, they've got a whole other revenue alongside to earn money off. People don't want to go out to drink, we want to go out to eat.
Yeah.
So it goes hand in hand. The whole point is, I went to the pub twice when they reopened. It was relatively calm. It was really, really, I mean, they have done everything to the T. I was shouted at by the manager on three occasions, on two separate occasions, because I was not within the perimeter that guidelines, ladies and gentlemen, and rules and signs are not
your forte.
Not my forte. And getting screamed at a manager, I was less confrontational and more pissed my knickers and nearly cried. No, going to the pubs and all that, I knew that if I made it a known thing, I'd just have various people appraising me. Yeah, yeah, good on you. Or saying, how fucking dare you? How stupid are you considering you're diabetic? To be honest,
never received a shielding letter. Yes, you need to be careful, but you have you have taken all the precautions that you need to take in order to be as safe as you possibly
and
can.
And I wouldn't have gone at all if I felt like
you were at risk.
I was at risk and I was vulnerable and everything. The luxury of these Wetherspoons, I have big garden areas.
Yeah.
And
that's the thing, you're outside. It's not like you were sat in a crowded pub, you know, really, really close to people that you shouldn't have been close to. You were, you were really safe.
I'm not going to lie. Sorry, didn't mean to cut you, but the thing was, the second time, it was hectic inside the pub.
Yeah.
That was where it was notching up, ratcheting up again. Where people were going, we can go out again. Garden, completely different. The people there, because it's just naturally, it's a wider expanse. Also, they want to segregate the smokers and the non-smokers, even before COVID. That's a perfect.
Yeah.
And you notice with all these shutdowns, every company, and this goes into Cineworld as well, they've actually used this time to revamp and improve where they had failings. In the case of Weatherspoons, they have a whole netting system that stops the notorious seagulls of Eastbourne.
Yeah, I was going to say, where we are, ladies and gents, is on the south coast of the UK, which means that we have the pain of not only listening to and trying to avoid the shit of, but also trying to avoid the buggers eating our chips. Well, they are our delightful seagulls.
They are like those...
they're just gannets.
They are. But what is it called? What were they called? Those Japanese pilots in World War II were kamikaze. They just dip and dive and assault you, not caring that they might break their neck against like the pavement. They will go for whatever is there. Also, I'm so surprised because I used to be quite talkative with the manager of Brighton's Cineworld, and I always inquired, why has this place not been refashioned? And I don't know what it's called, but there's this overall mapping of, we segregate certain monies for certain areas. If we think that we're going to earn more money from this certain area, we're going to invest all that money towards that particular site. In the wake of the new shopping mall, which is now called The Beacon and not the Arndale Centre in Eastbourne, they invested a lot to bring a very modern cinema. And
to be honest, I don't think they had much in the way of choice, because they moved from the cinema that was in the harbour, which wasn't that well used, to be honest, because a lot of people...
It was difficult to get to.
Yeah, a lot of people that don't drive, it's a long way, and it, you know, the buses are every 30 minutes to an hour a lot of the time, and on a Sunday even more difficult, in evenings even more difficult.
This is way before COVID, guys.
Yeah, absolutely, way before COVID, and they moved, and the thing is I think there was no way in hell they could start a brand new cinema in the way that it was built before. They had no choice but to update it, because it wasn't in existence.
And when this was all mapped out, it just took a few years to get it up.
Oh, yeah.
But we knew about it because they literally put that Cineworld sign up way before construction actually made.
Yeah.
So everyone's going, oh, wow, this cinema. And my reaction was, come on, guys, because I was based in Brighton, still am, but I was based in Brighton where I would go to Cineworld a lot often, more often, and the projectors conked out. They would show films in the wrong ratio. The audio didn't work.
To be honest, Eastbourne in the Crumbles was just...
Was it like that as
similar
well?
At times, yeah. Not as bad as Brighton.
No, not as bad as Brighton.
I mean,
because
it was virgin,
when
right?
me and my friend, Max, used to go to the Eastbourne one, we used to go, oh, this is quality, this! In comparison to Brighton, which was a cesspit. And I inquired to the manager or anyone working, and they just shook their heads and went, we're not worthy enough. I said, but this is a hot spot in Brighton. And they just said...
Bowling. Arcade games. McDonald's,
all the restaurants,
plus the other restaurants, Asda, Cineworld, free parking.
No, they weren't worthy enough, because when they refurbished it in 2009, new carpets and new counters, that's it, that's your take. And when digital cinema became the norm, cinemas like Cineworld really struggled to get them, to afford them. So, in this case scenario, I do think that the reputation of Brighton alone and how bad the cinema was, they're like, well, it's not worth it. We're trying to make Eastbourne a hot location. And they basically said that. So, imagine my fucking surprise when my granddad offered me some information today that they've revamped it. But not have they only revamped it. It's like something from, like, a 1960s futuristic film. They've got fucking three screens in one...
I would just like to take this opportunity to put on record these three words. So. Four words.
But the thing is, you may have mentioned it, but I just passed it off because I'm just like, no, they're not going to do that.
I knew it. I knew they're going to be closed for that.
But how can they refurbish it that quickly, within about, let's say, 6 months, but it took like 3 years, 2 years to make the Eastbourne
one? Because they had nothing. They were building on nothing in Eastbourne.
No, that is
in
very
Brighton,
true. It's already
existing.
They have
something in existence. They just need to refurb.
Oh, okay, that makes sense.
Anyway, Unhinged.
We went to go, we got turned away. First time, weren't happy about it. But it was for a reason. Boris basically went, wait. Before you get yourself excited, wear your masks. Don't wear your masks. Tweak your nipples. Don't tweak your nipples. Sorry, wrong broadcast. So, we went to see Unhinged today, first time. Okay, initial reaction going into the cinema, Laura.
Oh my god, yes. I literally blew kisses to the screen. I walked in, there's hand sanitizer, there's social distancing, we got popcorn, we got a drink. I didn't do anything, promised I wouldn't eat Zach's popcorn, still ate Zach's popcorn. You know, it was the same as usual. You know, I always put my phone at arm's length because I don't like people in my personal bubble, regardless of COVID. So my phone was at a far enough length, they didn't even want to see my
unlimited card. And that ginger guy's belly was social distancing from himself!
You know, and they say, oh, well, here's some sanitizer. And it was, when we walked in, there's some sanitizer there, please use it.
But even though we'd like bathed ourselves in our own, we were like, which, like, if you offered something for free, us British are like, oh, yes, thank you. Even you went,
la-di-da.
You put your brakes on, you're like,
I wanted to, like, fill up my bottles.
You should do that, yeah.
We go in Asda when no one's watching. But yeah, anyway, so it was all the same, just socially distanced. There's a few perspex screens to protect the staff. All the staff are wearing masks. You have to wear masks. This is the thing that I didn't understand. You must wear a mask inside the cinema, in the lobby, and inside the screens. However, if you're eating or drinking, you do not.
Well,
which makes zero sense.
Considering that it takes me a whole film to eat my popcorn and drink my drink, I spent half the film...
Without it on.
Also, to be honest...
There were six people in this screen, man.
And we were really far away.
Yeah.
They were right at the back. We were near halfway the middle. But these are, like, really expensive, like, Moti tier. I felt safe. I did feel safe. It wasn't the...
Oh, yeah. I certainly... When I took my mask off, I didn't think, like, oh, my God, don't breathe. I was okay.
Yeah.
I mean, we timed it very well because I personally, as do a lot of other people... I feel very claustrophobic with a mask on. And
I just can't deal with the steaming up.
I get really sweaty. I feel like I can't breathe. I can't stand breathing hot air.
Mm-hmm.
I can only breathe cool air, yeah. Which is why I really struggle with humidity anyway.
Yeah. Well, when you walked into the cinema, you went, because it had
air conditioning. And that was the thing. You know, we're in one of the hottest days of the year in the UK, and it is staggeringly hot outside. Even now at 9 o'clock, PM, it is incredibly hot. And actually to walk in to somewhere air conditioned where there are very few other people there because they are still worried, and I can appreciate that. And actually, you know, yeah, I did feel safe. And it was just one of those things where I felt like I was home again.
Yeah.
And I didn't realise until I walked in and I sat down how important this is for us, because it is our only luxury. But, you know, we timed it very well in the sense of we didn't want to... Because, as you know, when you go to the cinema or when you're in the UK, you get the adverts for the cars and the Coke, or Pepsi, actually, and all your other bits and bobs. And obviously there's the mandatory Cineworld, the Cineworld advert, duh.
You are in Cineworld. Guess what you can get, we know.
And then you get the teaser trailers, don't you, for the films.
Initially, yeah.
So we timed it to the point...
And then you get the teaser trailers of the teaser trailers thus advertising Cineworld, which we didn't get because all films have been fucking postponed.
Yeah, so we timed it basically that when we walked in, the car adverts would be over, we'd see a couple of trailers and the film would start. And we did. As soon as we walked in and we sat down, it went straight to the, here's some trailers you might like because you've chosen to watch this film.
And it was literally three film trailers.
Which were terrible. I know, one was okay.
Tenet, I'm really excited for. Spree, I have no fucking clue what...
I think I might go and see it just so that we can podcast about it.
Yeah.
And then the last one, I have no idea what that was.
That was an Australian baby teeth, an Australian love story. I might see it because I think that the trailer kind of...
I can't tell whether it's going to be a good film and the trailer just fucked it over, or whether the trailer is actually a true depiction of how bad the film's going to be.
when can you ever go off a trailer, though? It's weird now, isn't it? It's meant to sell you, but half the time it's like, no.
Anyway.
Unhinged. Anyway, you were going to...
No, I was just going to say, like, we timed it right, and it wasn't too bad in the sense of having to sit there for 20 minutes prior to the film starting. So, yes, Unhinged. I'll just give you some quick info. So, 2020 American thriller film directed by Derek Borte.
Who has done literally nothing of any note.
From a screenplay by Carl Ellsworth.
I'm not aware of what he's done, but...
The film stars Russell Crowe.
Yeah.
Unfortunately very obese. Sorry, Russell, but it's true.
He might as well be one of us sweat-drenched lot. Because yes. Throughout this film... We watched this in 4DX, they would have no fucking water squirts. Like, no, all the gallons of, like, water lined up. It's like, oh my God, Russell's on the move again.
yes, this film stars Russell Crowe, Karen Pistorius, not to be confused with Oscar Pistorius, Gabriel Bateman, Jimmy Simpson, and Austin P. McKenzie. And the film follows a young woman who is harassed by a seemingly unstable stranger following a road rage incident. We both watched the advert to this and agreed... Mutually agreed, didn't we, that this film should in fact be renamed
Road Rage,
not Unhinged. Because although Russell Crowe is unhinged in this film...
He is also...
Road Raging. Which they refer to on three separate occasions, but not once do they say anything about an unhinging and being unhinged.
And they do a very interesting thing with this film, with the title sequence that we had a little natter about when we got in the car. I liked how it set it up.
I would also just like to say that in the United States, this film is not being released until the 21st of August. So we've had this early. Germany got it first. Odd, but okay. So when we watched the trailer, I genuinely believed this was going to be more of a Fast and Furious adventure type film.
Did you really? Than
a thriller horror.
Did you not feel that, like, the whole point was he's just going to be fucking with this poor woman throughout?
Yeah, but it still felt like it was going to be a little bit less than it was.
You think it's going to be more car-orientated, where it's all centred in the car?
Yeah. I thought it was going to be more... Yeah, I thought it was going to be more kind of like action in the sense of Fast and Furious, which there was a lot of action, don't get me wrong. But more survivalist in one situation whereby she just keeps driving around trying to avoid this man and it doesn't work like that.
Yeah.
We both went in predicting 3 stars.
Yeah. I anticipated it for a 3-star.
We both came out agreeing that it was probably a top-end 3-star film.
A top-end 3-star and also a really good fucking film to reopen cinemas to.
Yes.
I really think it's really good and clever marketing. This was initially meant to be released this time anyway. So in the wake of COVID, when the trailer was initially released, I watched it and we were aware it was coming around around that time.
Yeah, yeah.
We were at that time also a little bit aware that the cinemas may reopen at the time. And we kind of had that sense of this might be a good film to come through.
Break you back into it.
It's not mind-numbingly boring. It's not trying to be anything that it's not. It's not going to win awards. It is escapism in the best sense that the Fast and Furious does, but it's got the survivalist thriller aspects that you personally love, I personally love. Also, it's got Russell Crowe, who, I want to say, a lot of critics have been... I don't understand this new opinion of Russell Crowe, that he's at a stage in his career where he's washed up, washed out, a fat man who no one's going to cast, and his career has gone like Nicolas Cage's. Russell Crowe has been doing quite a lot of stuff. Weight-wise, I'm not going to lie, I was really scared for him. I thought, oh my God, has he got to that stage in his career where he's like... And I got scared for him. Not only does it stop you from being able to get jobs, because we know how image-oriented, but then I kind of settled in myself with the hypothesis that he is such a known name now that maybe Hollywood will accept this. And we all know Russell Crowe is a character actor. He's good at playing characters. So even if he has put on a bit of paunch, which he has throughout the years, for different roles, for different reasons, and he wouldn't say himself he's a method actor in that sense. He said he likes to give... Because he did a film called The Nice Guys with Ryan Gosling, and he put on paunch for that. And everyone was like, oh my God. And it was the initial reaction I had. they were having that reaction to him in that film, but I didn't, because I was like, oh, it's Russell Crowe being Russell Crowe. If he needs to be the muscled Maximilius character in Gladiator, he will. If he needs to be the skinny man boxer for Cinderella Man, he will. If he needs to be the big bearded nut job and unhinged, I thought he will. But he was... He had gained weight already for a role, a TV series with Naomi Watts, I think called The Insider, and I went on his Instagram, and I'm not going to lie, I was really worried for him. I thought, oh my God, have you got to that point where you're like, I'm Russell Crowe, I don't give a fuck. But then that opinion that I had, critics have taken, but have somehow circumnavigated and created a whole mythology leading up to him gaining weight, basically saying he's lost weight, his heart isn't in it anymore, he's just always turning up the Russell Crowe dial to 11, he's just doing a Nicolas Cage, doing it for the money, easy money, he's just, you know, letting himself go, he don't give a fuck. Whoa, 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 when the fuck has Russell Crowe done a B-movie or done a straight-to-DVD movie like Nicolas Cage, who, you know, has to do it because he's still got a lot of debts to pay off and isn't actually that good an actor. So when I saw Russell Crowe mention that he was having a day in the office amongst broken down cars, I was like, oh, you filmed it at the same time as doing this other role. I was generally frightened, but the weight works. Because it gives him that presence. He is a fucking monster. He's sweaty. He's intense. But this great big physicality of the man, this grim determination to fuck with this woman's day. He's like, you think you've had a bad day. You don't know fucking anything, love. Mm. And how big a monstrous a presence he is.
It's very intimidating.
It is.
But especially when the Karen Pistorius is very... She's quite short. She's very slight.
Yeah.
There's not much to her.
Yeah.
I can imagine feeling that way if I was to be in her position.
When it, especially in a man who's in that monster... Like, he's in a monster truck. What is it, a Range Rover or Jeep?
It's a Jeep.
Jeep. It is an embodiment of that type of character.
And I mean, it's got great big steel bars at the front.
Yeah.
And those types of Jeeps are made to ram.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. He is basically the embodiment of his Jeep, isn't
he? Yeah, he is. And I think that is perfect casting in a sense. Also,
absolutely.
I don't think that Russell Crowe took this because of the money. I think Russell Crowe took it because he can play this character to a T. Russell Crowe can lend that type of menace. But also, I'm not going to lie, I sent a comment. You're right.
I've got indigestion, you continue.
Yeah, me too. I've been swallowing these burps. Russell Crowe has been advertising it on his Instagram, and I looked at the comments and people had just been horrible. So I thought, me being me, I'm going to leave a comment. And I said what I liked about it was, it shouldn't be called unhinged, it should actually be called damaged. Because he is a damaged man.
Because
there are moments of this vulnerability. He questions his actions in the beginning. He takes the wedding ring off. He's either built himself up, or he's, by taking off that wedding ring in the beginning... Because we're introduced into the film, which isn't much of a spoiler, which really sees him lose the plot, go beyond that level. He takes off his wedding ring and he's decided, I'm going to kill my wife's lover, who I gather is actually the lawyer, the divorce lawyer, because he makes that comment later about, I bet you're not just lying, I bet you're fucking, is he fucking you? Because you notice, he goes in with the intention to kill the husband. It's only when the wife gets in the way that red flag to a bull scenario comes in. Mm. So once he's gone over that threshold, he's already a wanted man. So when he comes into confrontation with the actress, because she honked him, he's already a man on the edge. He's really damaged. He's done worse. He can't go back from what he's done. But he's on that scale of he can really go into the deep depths of, you know. You know, he can go in that direction where there's no coming back from it. And there's a moment where he basically is saying to her, I recognise you're having a bad day. God, I'm having a bad day. And he wanted a little bit of recognition. Doesn't get the reaction he wants. And that's where it... And I like that subtlety and that nuance. And it's actually a man just wanting a little bit of recognition, especially from a woman. And then when he gets more insight to the woman, it throws more fuel to the fire. She's getting a divorce. No. No.
He's just had a divorce.
Yeah. No, don't. And yeah, it's. And I think the casting of Russell Crowe is the calibre. I think, in the other hand, of an unknown, we wouldn't be as engaged. Like, Russell Crowe isn't just playing it to 11. He's actually invested a rather subtlety and nuances to it. Just because he's bigger and he's not your stereotypical what Russell Crowe should be or the type of film that he should be in. I think he's really fucking good in this. I also like that even as hefty and brutish as he is, he's really lithe and athletic. And it's really weird, that juxtaposition, that you're really quite good on your feet for a big, big guy.
The thing is that you don't have to be thin to be fit.
No.
Without giving too many spoilers away, because I think probably 50%, if not more, of our listeners are American.
We think you should see it.
We do. I just want to say, as a, like a pre-warning, I was not expecting this to be as gory as it was.
Oh, yeah.
And for a thriller that I wasn't expecting to be in any way jumpy, I jumped on three occasions with a genuine, like... So it's just putting it out there. It is unpredictable. You don't know what's going to happen. And please, if you are bored in the first 10 or 15 minutes, stick with it. Because yes, it may seem a little bit slow, but it is setting the context and it is so incredibly important. And actually,
it sets up a lot of things.
I lost concentration in those first 10, 15 minutes, and I was trying to add that up during all the action. And I found I was starting to lose the action because of the fact that I was going,
I did turn around at one point and go, we need to remember this bit because it's going to pay off at the end. Like, there is predictability factors, of course, like all films, but there's certain scenes where it hits you fucking hard. Yeah. And maybe it's because we haven't had that experience in the cinema for so long, it hits us harder than it actually should have. I don't know. But I've got to give it to Derek, who hasn't done anything of notable... of any report or retort or whatever you call it. I like that Russell Crowe put his name to such a small film, because it is small relatively in budget and in scale, but it is a very gripping, fast paced film. I think Russell Crowe is very entertaining. I think any critic who thinks it's easy to shit on Crowe because he's not fitting that status and iconography as intended, my fucking first initial reaction, as said before, was concern, because I was like, oh my god, why is this guy, like, 20 stone? Something must be going on. Whereas Crowe is like, no, it was for another role. And it was like, oh, thank God, where critics are like, he's let himself go, he's only doing shit. When has Russell Crowe done shit? Yes, he's done some films that aren't that good, and some roles he wasn't too good. Robin Hood, his accent may have been off. Fucking class. Not only does he lend name, he lends his talent. And he's so intimidating. He's so fucking petrifying. He is, like you said, the embodiment of that car coming up your ass. For the action sequences, I thought they were very well staged, orchestrated, great editing. I noticed that there was three editors on this. So I think when it came to those sequences, because it is so orientated around certain moments. Also, there's a moment in the film concerning a lawyer, concerning a coffee mug, concerning Russell Crowe and a mobile phone and our lead actress. That is the most tense, most surprising sequence I've seen in a film since The Invisible Man, when the initial, you know what I'm talking about, happens. I think that's all I have to say. I would like to see what the director does from this. I really hope that studios might recognise that he's a good director, and I would like to see I'd like to see him to do a similar film in vain like this. I'd also like to see him to work with Russell Crowe again. You can tell when a director and an actor have a comfortable relationship. You can tell that the director was like, I believe in your performance in this, Russell. And Russell Crowe was like, well, cheers, mate. So, obviously, aren't you believing me? You're going to let me do whatever the fuck I want. Terrible Australian accent. Do not sound like Russell Crowe. But anyway, 3 stars. I really recommend you go see it. It is such a good... And I did not enjoy the cinema experience. Not for the film. I found it very difficult to acclimatise to the... I don't know where it is, the environment. I really... Like, the screen was bigger than I'd remembered. I was sweating, I was getting very anxious, but the film still left a really good impression on me. It's very hard for me sometimes to, like I think it's to do with the autism, which we'll segue on to next. I find it difficult to break routine, and when that routine's broken, another one materialises and takes place. So I did find it really difficult. I didn't, like many people, come up with an excuse not to wear my fucking mask, though. Anyone who goes in there trying to find an excuse not to wear their mask because, oh, I don't like it. I'm an autistic man. Shit like that does bother me myself, but I'm willing. I was more than willing to wear that mask. Mm. But we got to a point where, by the time we finished our popcorn and I finished my drink, we looked at each other and we're like, well, the film's coming to an end. Everyone else in here is far away enough that we feel secure that we can just unclip it and have it partly by our faces. But, yeah, anything you want to say, add on.
I recommend that you go and see it. enjoy
support
it.
Your cinemas, because they need you right now.
Support your local cinemas. And support the film industry, because this is tough, man. Mm-hmm. This is tough for everyone. Be safe and just go back and enjoy what you used to enjoy.
Yeah, definitely.
That's all I can say.
Definitely, and definitely.
And just to finish off, it is, I know I've already said it, but yeah, 3 stars.
3 stars. 3 stars for Unhinged. Also, we are planning tomorrow to hopefully see Proxima, the Eva Green drama, isn't it?
Yeah.
So hopefully in a future episode we'll be reviewing a few films. I really want to try and convince Laura to go see Batman Begins in cinemas for this podcast, but I'm still half and half not knowing whether it's a venture worthwhile. I've tried to convince
10 people retweet.
They won't, though. No one, you're just saying that because you want to out, so you'd have to see it. No one has ever really engaged with us that much when we ask of you to, but anyway, yeah, we're seeing Proxima, might be seeing...
Also seeing Inception.
We're seeing Inception, 10-year anniversary. I really hope that the new Wonder Woman and Tenet trailer... Apparently, before Inception, we see the first 8 minutes of Tenet. As an exclusive, so that might be a good taster. They've done this for years at IMAX cinemas with all Christopher Nolan films. They show the prologue to the film to get people hyped. And because of how everything's going with the cinemas at the moment, they're like, instead of doing it for IMAX, I think we need to do it for
every cinema.
And Christopher Nolan has been very vocal about, he really feels that cinema going needs to be encouraged, but it also needs to become the norm again, and I agree with him. I don't even think it's a case of, I want you to see my film, because his film can be postponed like any other film. I think he really believes in the community spirit.
It's gonna just start going downhill because people just don't want to do it anymore.
Because of that, it is a community spirit type thing. Yeah. It is a gathered mass type thing that you'll enjoy, and I think that Tenet would also be the perfect film for people to go see as a big event.
I think the thing is it's safe now.
It is. I think it is. It's safe enough now. I mean, if anyone is poorly in and around you and there is a potential, don't do it.
Yeah.
But...
if you're poorly yourself, don't do it.
Yeah. So, yeah. Shifting on to...
Autism,
living with autism. We watched something, came up just randomly... on Netflix, that was what is it called? Looking for Love on the Spectrum,
something like that, yeah.
And we watched it, and I said to Laura, I think it would be interesting if we did a kind of episode where we talk about what it's like for her personally.
Love on the Spectrum.
Love on the spectrum, where we talk about what it's like and what she's kind of. Basically an episode about what it's like to live with me in a pub for being, but also, again, opening it up to other topics of autism. Then Laura had this discussion with me an hour leading up to this of she didn't want it to be we don't usually do. You explain it, because I'm just...
Basically, for me, it's very difficult to just talk upon a subject. I need someone to bounce off, and I need kind of a little bit of guidance in with regard to what kind of could be covered or needs to be covered, because I could say a range of things that could quite potentially come off as very biased.
Mm.
And I don't want it to come across that way. So something we haven't done before, but I think would work best in this situation, is to go for a more interview type technique, whereby Zach will, and I think he's got some questions lined up in his head, he'll ask me a few questions, and then I can then try and answer them as honestly as I can from a... both an objective and a biased point of view, I think, in that sense.
And then there's no room for accusation of it being biased, because that's the nature of the conversation.
Basically, it's going to be my honest opinion whether anyone likes it or not.
Yeah. So, anyway, hello, Laura. Welcome. Thank you for being here in your own front room.
Thank you so much for having me in my own front room. How the hell did you get in here?
Ah, I climbed through your window.
You crazy psycho.
Anyway, what did autism mean to you before you met me? What was it for you?
I mean, I had, if you like, the benefit of dating someone with autism prior to meeting
Which I don't think he had.
I think he had something that I like to refer to as arsehole syndrome, whereby he just liked to use the fact that he supposedly had diagnosed autism to be a genuine dick. And
a lot of people do that.
To get away with being horrible.
Yeah.
However, some of his actions were very naive and didn't seem to have a lot of arsehole behind it, yet it just seemed like he was being stupid. Autism to me before I met you was something that I wasn't scared of, but I didn't, and I still don't fully understand.
Mm, I don't think I do either.
I don't think anyone does. But something that ultimately wouldn't affect me in a relationship.
Yeah.
And I'd made that decision quite early on, I think. And something ultimately that if I were to find someone that could be open and could explore it with me, then I'd be really intrigued to do that throughout the relationship, to work together to learn more about each other.
Yeah.
And I think it's also an opportunity for the educator in me, and I don't mean that in a patronising way, to kind of understand how someone with autism works, and likewise share my experience of how non-autism works.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Nothing else from that?
I don't think so.
That's pretty much. Interesting. Very interesting. I do really find that really intriguing. A lot of people called Asperger's the arsehole syndrome because people on the spectrum, Asperger's, or as the Americans call it, Asperger's,
I love a good Asperger, don't you?
No. Can be very matter-of-fact, very blunt. And a lot of people take that as, ooh, that's the definitive variation of autism. You're to the point, you're matter of fact, and you have no social awareness.
There's a difference between being matter of fact and being an absolute
And arse. A lot of people have cottoned on to this stereotype and this cliche, applied it to themselves so they can get away with bad behaviour, which causes the stigma around Asperger's or Asperger's itself. Certain characteristics of an autistic person can be recognised. You do recognise there are certain characteristics in autistic people. The very robotic speech, the shut-off, almost inclusiveness of themselves and their interests. But not every autistic person, I believe, who are or the higher functioning, they are the hardest to distinguish, but you don't need to distinguish us. You don't need to distinguish those who are, lower functioning autistics. It's a very broad spectrum.
And I think that's something, sorry, I know you haven't asked me a question, right, but something that was very, I want to use the word blinding, but I'm not sure it's quite right. But I'm going to go for it. Something that was very blinding to me when I first started talking to Zach was the fact that was the first thing that you said to me was, I've got to tell you something.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, oh, right, so you're a serial killer and actually you've just come out of prison. Like, I'm autistic. And I'm pretty sure if I didn't text the same way, I definitely in my head went, and?
Yeah.
Or, yeah.
Yeah, then you basically messaged me, and I thought I'd offended you in my interpretation of what my condition was. You told me how much you had an issue with it being a condition.
Yeah, I did, because you referred to it as a condition, and I felt that that was derogatory, and I felt that it's not. It's I've always said that it's more of a gift than it is a condition. It shouldn't be something that should be used as a derogatory term. Oh, you've got a condition. And I disagree with the use of that word, although it is the matter of fact scientific word.
Mm-hmm.
I still don't like it.
Yeah.
And yeah, you thought that I'd got offended by the fact that you'd used the word condition for your own issues.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was very strange for me, because I, the way you said it was like, oh, I've got autism. I'm like, okay, cool.
Yeah, yeah. And then the other bombshell was, by the way, I have a kid that I don't see.
Again, okay, cool.
Yeah, okay. Second question. Enlightenment in the early stages of recognising my... Okay, I'm not voicing this very well. I'm not that good at it. What was the... what did you recognise in me that was... You would go, that's autistic, when we first got together?
Couple of things. Mainly the concentration level.
Mm.
If you are doing something, there is absolutely no way in hell... Can you have a conversation with me, listen to what I'm saying, or do anything else?
Yeah.
And still to this day, I can look at you and be like, oh, you just listen to me. But I have to remind myself that you can't.
Mm.
But the thing is, and there's no nice way of saying this, autism is usually...
Say it how you feel it, baby.
It's usually an immaturity.
Oh, yeah.
A naivety.
Oh, yeah.
So when a child is doing something and they refuse to listen to you,
yeah,
they're being difficult.
Yeah.
And it is very hard not to then say, don't be so bloody difficult.
Mm.
Which I've said this morning, because... My initial human reaction is, please stop being...
Oh, difficult. Yeah, you've snapped at me, you cheeky bitch.
But that's my initial human reaction. I can't help that. I try. But there are some times where I do. I just snap and I'm like, stop, it's bloody difficult. Because it comes across as you're being a child and I'm being an adult. And it's so hard sometimes not to, like, say.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and it, initially, that was one of the things. It was like, he literally cannot concentrate on more than one thing. And I have got used to that, for the most part, but there are still times where
Of course it's gonna lapse, isn't it? Because it's a different situation and dependent on your mood.
Exactly.
Also dependent on my mood. Some days I'm quite cognizant,
Yeah, but the thing is, if I'm having a bit of a rubbish day, and I don't mean a stupidly rubbish day, I mean just a little bit annoyed.
Well, you were just a bit exasperated and hot.
Yes. Exactly. So you just get...
See, autistic people can recognise it in others, even if it takes like 5 hours down the line.
The only other thing that I think is immediately obvious, as far as the autism's concerned, is the compulsion to move all the time.
Oh, yeah. Like I'm doing now.
Yeah. It's the shaking your leg, shaking your foot, shaking your arm, ticking, or stimming, or both. Mumbling to yourself, all that kind of things, those kind of things, they're all very both infuriating at times, because when I'm in a position personally where I just need some light space, you're always moving or making a sound.
Well, stop hanging around me 24/7. My nan keeps dropping hints to you. You spend too much time together.
But that's the thing. It's for me, I have to realise that you can't help it.
It's an honour that you love to be around me 24/7, because everyone else isn't accepting of those
ways. What I'm saying is, I'm not saying for a second that it's a bad thing, but I'm saying to you, honestly, and I'm saying to people that are listening, it's not easy.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sitting here, and I'm not saying that in a critical way towards you or anybody else with autism, but I think there just needs to be a recognition that, first of all, and I know you haven't asked me a question, I'm sorry, first of all, I don't love Zach, I don't love you because you are autistic and I'm taking advantage of you, or you're easy to be with, or because it's just it's just easy to do it.
Yeah.
I'm not the type of person that wants to try and change you or cure your autism.
No.
And I'm not the type of person to just think you're an in-between.
Yeah.
For me, it's actually, you have an amazing personality and we can have some incredible conversations.
Yeah.
Beyond anything I've ever discussed with anyone in my entire being.
Yeah.
And autism is just something I have to deal with, whether it's annoying sometimes or not.
Yeah, and it's funny that you say that, because you approach autism quite, and it took me a long time to do it myself. Autism isn't a separate thing from me. It isn't. Autism is me. I am autism. My personality is dictated by that part of me. And a lot of people, family members or strangers, they always have to be a departmentalisation. There's the autism, but then
there's Zach, and then there's autism.
Yeah.
And I think the thing is, for me,
and I think autism is used as an excuse for a lot of things, and in a way it can be, but it's an explanation.
But sometimes it's hard, as somebody non-autistic, I'm just going to keep myself as non-autistic because it's so easy to say normal.
Yeah.
And that's not fair.
Yeah.
Somebody who is non-autistic, it is very, very hard, and it's so hard to explain without sounding like an arse. It is really, really hard to not think that you are using it as an excuse.
Yeah.
Because sometimes, and this is the thing, is that your downside or is it mine?
Mm.
You know?
Yeah.
Is it yours or is it everybody else's?
Yeah.
Because sometimes I look at you and I think, why can't you just learn?
Yeah.
And actually it's not that easy.
No,
and I don't mean that in a critical or horrible way, but that as a non-autistic person, and probably a vast majority of the non-autistic population that are out there, it's very easy to just go, stop being such a fucking child.
Mm.
It is very easy. And that's what I mean when I say there are days when I am irritable. You know, like, it's like the new medication I'm on right now for the pain in my back, right? They make me snappy as hell. I've managed to curb it as best I can, but there are days I lose it. And I don't mean lose it like punching the living crap out of each other.
No.
I mean, some days I just snap and I'm like, oh, crap.
It's just random kids on the street.
But that's the thing. Some days we are irritable, whether you have got any form of problem or not.
Yeah.
You will always have a day where you're not quite feeling up to your usual, and you're a bit more irritable, you're a bit more agitated, and you could even be a little aggressive.
Yeah.
And I don't mean that, again, in the fighting people.
Yeah.
I mean just feeling aggressive.
Yeah.
That is difficult then for me to... that then I feel like it feels like my brain is usually quite open. It's I just kind of take lots of things in and I deal with them and I kind of compartmentalise them and then I think and react.
Yeah.
When I'm particularly irritated or agitated, it closes that in. So if something comes in and I go straight back out again. So on those days, I could be perceived as not particularly accepting of autism and the traits that come with that.
Yeah. Yeah, and I'm not going to lie, there are those moments when that happens where I feel like you're not taking them on board, but I know it's not the case at all. I am very, very aware, and this is what I mean when there's a luxury with certain people on being the lower spectrum. They don't have that awareness of how their actions and attitudes affect others, whereas a lot of my autistic tendencies is to be super attenuated to my autism. I'm hyper aware of it. I'm hyper... aware of it in hindsight, and that's really fucking difficult for me, because there's almost like a possession side of it sometimes. I can feel it coming, it's going to come, but I can't dial it.
But I think sometimes that's your downfall.
Hmm.
Because you're thinking, and I'm not saying it's your fault that you can control it, but sometimes there is just so much that you're trying to do to stop or to control that you're actually bringing it on.
Yeah.
And that doesn't help you.
Well, my mind is going, I mean,
a million miles an hour.
Every day, continually. Whether it needs to or not, and I find it very difficult not to have a mind like that. sometimes I find it odd that when I do have a day of calm and tranquility in myself, I have to bring it on. I have to bring something onto myself, and then there goes the obsessions. But it's interesting you say that. So, another question. I had it on the tip of my tongue.
And now it appears to have gone down your throat.
It has. It was... What's it like to live with me? Autistic-wise.
I thought you were going to say autistically then.
Autistically living with me whilst not being... Should pretty much do, off and on, different locations.
I mean, you're easier than my ex non autistic boyfriend that I lived with for 6 months. Does that count?
Yeah.
I mean,
do you reckon? Okay, let's, because we kind of basically done that already. What are the autistic things that you recognise and you think, okay, I can live with that?
There's nothing I can't live with. I don't think I'd be with you.
Okay. Bad question.
No, I get your point. The thing is...
Has being exposed to my autism changed your perception of it?
No.
No?
No.
Fuck you, I'm leaving. I'm so special, I am. No.
Because this is the thing.
Hasn't it given you a broader insight to it a little bit?
No.
No.
Because I can't apply what I've learnt about you to everyone else that's autistic.
That's very true.
So how can it have... It's broadened my views on your autism.
Yeah.
But not on autism itself. No. Because you can't.
No.
I can't... Like I said. ...learn from you and apply it to somebody outside that says, I'm autistic.
Mm-hmm.
Because it doesn't work like that.
No, it doesn't.
So, no.
This is why I've asked the question. I like this.
No, it hasn't broadened my views on autism... But yes, it has broadened my views on your autism.
Okay, I really like that.
Or your autistic traits.
Yeah, I really like that. I do. I really like that.
I mean, quote it and put it on a book somewhere.
What has my autism... How has my autism affected you?
It's made me feel very protective at times.
Okay. Oh, is this of people, personal, family, what ways? Socially?
Just of you in general.
Generally.
Do and you also
see me like a deer in the headlights sometimes?
No.
Okay.
When
a lot of people like to assume that.
A lot of people like to protect people with any form of neurological condition because they feel that they're too naive to live their life.
Mm.
Truth is, when I look at my life and I look at yours, there are some ways in which you have broadened your views on certain things more than I have, and vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
There are some things that you know a lot more about,
mm-hmm.
and that you could apply a lot more knowledge about than I could, and again, vice versa.
Yeah.
The way in which I mean, as far as the protection is concerned, is when the people that do not understand... And when I say protection, I'm not sure I necessarily mean protection, so I'm going to go into it. As an example, somebody will say to me, well, couldn't Zach do this? And that's not a criticism, and that's not a, he should be doing something.
Mm-hmm.
It is a genuine question. What is it about the autism? And they don't say it properly, but it's, what is it about the autism that means he can't do this?
Yeah.
But what they actually say is, why can't he do this?
Yeah.
And I find myself at that moment saying, okay, please look at X, Y, Z, A, B, C, D, E, F, G, and all of the other letters in
H, I, J, K, L, M, N, O, P.
As to why
Q-I-S.
That would be very difficult for Zach to do.
Yeah.
And equally, I find myself educating a lot of people when they tend to come across as overcritical.
Mm.
So, for an example, somebody said to me, oh, I'm really struggling right now because a little while ago, from the beginning of the COVID outbreak towards very recently, there were specific arrows and specific ways in which we had to go around a specific supermarket. Now, Zach, with that one mind, one thought mind, means that when you walk into the supermarket, you have to go up an aisle and back down to get to the books.
But because Zach is just thinking about he wants to look at the book section, he goes against the arrows and technically against the one-way system, which has not only upset people in the supermarket, and I won't go into that, but it's also come out in conversation with various people between me and somebody else about how it really frustrates them that people ignore the one-way system.
Mm.
And I find myself protecting you in a sense of educating them to understand why it is that some people feel that they cannot obey the one-way system. Now, some people are lazy and some people are just plain rude and they just can't, they just don't care.
Yeah.
But I find myself educating people in that sense, therefore protecting you by saying, please understand this from an autistic from Zach's point of view, which could be considered to be an autistic point of view, which is when you've got something in mind, you go to it, you don't do the round the houses thing.
Yeah.
You don't take into consideration things around you, people around you, or rules.
Mm.
You do what you want to go and do. And for Zach personally, that means going against the arrows to look at the books, because it makes sense.
Mm.
It's straightforward. Why would I go all the way up that aisle, come round the end and come all the way back down that aisle when the books are right there?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I mean when I say I protect you.
Yeah. And you protected me as well in Asda, in your vein, and I didn't react well to it.
I think that's, you know, in this circumstance, I don't like using the words he's autistic.
Mm.
Because that, for me, and I've had a conversation with a very close friend whereby he said to me one day, because he knows that Zach has autism, he says to me one day, is autism used as an excuse to be an arsehole? And I said, yes, it can be.
Mm.
And the thing is basically, this boy was walking along with his mother, looking down at his phone, and this boy walked straight into my friend. My friend said, please watch where you're going, and his mum went, he's autistic, leave him alone!
Mm.
When in reality, his mum, who is not autistic, could have helped him in order to not walk straight into him.
Yeah.
If he was on his own, it would be a different story.
Yeah.
But so in this situation whereby you went to get the books and this woman had decided to take it upon herself to make a remark, for me, I don't feel it's appropriate to walk up to that woman and say to her, he's autistic.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't think that I should be excusing her behaviour with your autism. Mm. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Whether you're autistic or not, you've got no right to speak to him like that.
Mm-hmm.
Which is why I always take the tactic of walk away.
Mm.
Because it just doesn't, it just, because she says something, I go back, he's autistic. Well, I'm either going to get a, yeah, right, or I'm going to get a whole, oh, I'm so sorry, he's autistic, I don't want either.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want sympathy for me or for you.
Mm-hmm.
And I certainly don't want somebody to discriminate further.
Yeah.
Which is why I take it upon myself to just...
To be honest, I think that woman, whether it was going to be me or not, I think she was just going to have that attitude to anyone, and she put herself in that line of fire to get me.
But again, it takes... You know, as far as we know, she could have been having a bad day.
Mm.
We all have bad days, we all get a bit snappy. It doesn't excuse her behaviour, but I don't feel that your autism should therefore excuse anybody else's behaviour either.
Or my own.
No.
Mm-hmm.
In some circumstances, yes.
Yeah.
But I don't feel that it's like, oh, you've reacted in that way, so I should now say that you're autistic. Why should that be the case?
Mm.
Why should it matter? She specifically stepped in front of you. I knew she wanted a fight, whether I came out with autism or fucking cancer. It doesn't matter.
Mm.
It doesn't matter what I said to her. It wouldn't have mattered. She would have fought.
Mm.
And that, I think that's the thing. Is
well,
I
it was,
can...
indicative of that, because she followed us around the whole bloody store.
Yeah, and you can tell with those kinds of people. But again, that's something that I can perceive quite easily, because I read a lot about my surroundings, whereas you have that one-track...
But even though I had that one-track mind, in my one-track mind, I was aware of her presence, but I didn't think for 1 minute that it was going to cause such a ruckus for her.
No. And a lot of people would feel that way, but I think that's the thing, is I can read a lot more of a situation quicker, perhaps, than you can sometimes.
Yeah.
Not saying all the time.
What else do you notice of me doing with autism that may be completely polar opposite to yourself?
There is a sense of kind of filling spaces, quietness. So if we're having a conversation and there's a natural pause, you tend to fill it. And if you are having a conversation with someone and you're not really interested in the answer, you will cut in and you will continue to talk about something that you're interested in.
An observation you made
when you were talking to your mum.
Yeah.
So one day you asked your mum where she'd been, what she'd done that day, and she began to tell you, and to be fair, I was bored, but she began to tell you the ins and outs of what she'd bought in Poundland. And I noticed that you, I could tell you'd stopped listening because you were elsewhere. Yeah. And I pick up on that quite easily. I know when you're not listening and you're like, I'm bored now and you're kind of doing it now.
No, I'm looking at you.
No, I know, but it's still that thinking on the side. And I know you're not very good at that. So I know if you're thinking on the side, you're probably not focusing on what your mum's bought from Poundland. And then she was midway through, and I mean midway through a word, and you went, so anyway, I did this the other day, blah, 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 and I just looked at your mum, and your mum looked at me like, okay. And it all... You know,
I didn't tell her what I did. I was more concerned about Bryony.
Yeah, but there was no argument. There was no animosity. But I could tell. It's like, yeah, he's not listening. He's not interested. He's about to... And then he cuts in. And I can see that because I personally... I'm very good at reading a room, reading a situation.
And from experience, you feel like I cut into you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
At times.
Yeah.
Not always. But there are times where I can't get a word in edgeways.
Yeah.
Because there are things, and that also comes into that, there's so much in your head that you have to get it all out immediately.
Yeah.
And I think there's also an element of, because your head is running as quickly as it is, and this is a new theory that I've literally just thought of, because things are running through your head so quickly, you know if you don't say it now, there's no way in hell you're going to remember it in 2 minutes time until finished.
Exactly.
And that's interesting, but... As an outsider, as a non-autistic person, that can be hella frustrating.
Yeah.
Because it's just like, well, why can't... Because for me, you've gone, you're not listening to me anymore, and then you cut in, and I'm like, excuse me, am I not worthy?
Yeah.
Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
Now, a lot of people say, well, that's your insecurity, Laura. Yeah, you're probably absolutely right, that is my insecurity. However, sometimes it is very, very hard to be cut across... And you do. You begin to feel insecure about yourself even more because you feel that you're not. Your conversation isn't worthy. Your words aren't worthy.
I hope you know. I'm cutting off now. I hope you know that that's never my intention. I usually throw it out. Yeah, for the reasons that you've beautifully put. But also because I feel that by what I'm going to add to it, it's just going to build off of the conversation. Because I do. For someone who's autistic, I do like talking.
Yeah. And that is really good. But there is... And the thing is this might not just be autism. This may also be your childhood and how you were brought up. Many people, such as me, that's a single and only child, tends to feel that they're the only person that's ever had been listened to, ever been spoken to, ever, you know, had ears to listen to their stories. So when someone cuts in, it's like, how dare you? Because I'm not used to it. I haven't lived with siblings to cut into me all the time.
Well, the thing is, I think it's different with you because no one actually has ever listened to me.
I was just about to come on to that. As an opposite, because you have had a family that perhaps doesn't understand you.
No, they don't, not at all.
I'm being diplomatic. Having a family that perhaps doesn't understand you, it's much easier to shut you up by cutting into you.
Yeah.
Which means that makes you almost hyperactive with your words because you want to be heard. So between us, we're like a bomb.
Yeah.
Because I have only ever been listened to and people cutting into me, I'm not used to because I've only ever been an only child. And you feeling like you've never been heard before.
Yeah.
Clash. Yeah. I'm doing a little hand movement, guys, sorry.
Can you hear that?
But it is, it's an instant clash, isn't it?
That's very interesting.
I've got my childhood issues, I say in quotations. You've got yours again in quotations. Us coming together means that there's one or two ways this can go, and luckily it's gone the second way, which is the better way. One way is that we both end up going fuck off and fuck you, or the second way where we talk about our insecurities and our childhood issues and everything else, and we realise that actually, we can communicate about this and we can deal with it.
Yeah, giving context to the whole... Not rationalising the irrational, but it is kind of...
It's giving context and actually a bit of understanding, and we both have that. We both have understanding of each other. Your childhood was shit, my childhood was shit. I'm not saying yours was any shitter than mine was, or vice versa. It's about you have your problems, I have my problems, we're going to talk about it, and we're going to best describe how we felt and see how we can alter our ways the best as possible, autism allowing, to make this the best we can. And sometimes we clash. But most of the time we're alright.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. It's just about finding workarounds, isn't it?
Exactly, yeah. That's very interesting. Now,
Shut up now, I don't want to talk to you anymore. That's not a question, Zach.
I'm getting bored of this conversation now. No, I want to end it on... I want to end it on something...
Zach's thinking. You can smell the smoke. It's like an audio commentary. You can hear the cogs turning ever so gently.
Not like gently.
like a ticking of an indicator / turn signal.
It's,
Smoke is getting darker now from his ears. Sorry, I'm putting you off.
No, I'm visualising it now.
So am I. But it's putting you off.
It's, Do you want to ask me any questions?
No.
Are we the future?
Are we the future? Fuck off.
No, no, I think we'll leave it at that. I think we've covered most bases of it.
I have a question that I think you should have asked.
Okay, tell me.
I think you should have asked whether I have any concerns about our children being autistic.
I actually was thinking that before I asked it, but then I didn't want to ask it just in case you thought it was going to be a bit too raw to the nerve.
Ask the question.
Are there any concerns that autism will be carried across to our future offspring?
Now, before everybody goes and turns this off, yes, there are concerns. And the reason why I have concerns is this. Is because I see... Do not get emotional, Laura. I see the pain that you go through on a daily basis, and I see that struggle.
Mm.
And I wouldn't wish that on anyone.
No.
And I'm really, really glad that I have been able to meet you and I've been able to help you and you've been able to help me with various things. I can't cure it.
Mm.
But I wouldn't ever wish for that struggle to be on anyone, whether it's my children or not.
Yeah.
So, yes, there are concerns, but if our children are autistic, they're our children, it doesn't matter.
Mm. Yeah, that's true. Also, don't get upset. That's beautiful what you said there. Of course, yeah, there is going to be concern. I'm under the belief that my child, Luca, has autism. He showed very marked traits of it that I recognised when I saw him. Something that his mum offhandedly referred to as, he's like you, he's a fucking freak.
Nice.
But do you think there will be some reinforcement or some, at least some, if our child was autistic, at least they've got someone to turn to in a sense of recognition?
Yeah, I mean, I would feel confident as a mother knowing that my, hopefully by that stage, husband has autism, and therefore I know I can at least try and apply some of those techniques that I have used with you to
and
help our relationship
yourself,
to then not, like I said earlier, you can't apply the same, you know, the learning from one to another, but I can use, I'm not saying the learning from you I could use, what I can use is my techniques to cope personally, because it's tough on the partner that isn't autistic.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to lie, I'm not going to say that it's all, you know, plain sailing, because sometimes it can be incredibly challenging, but all I can do is then know that I have got the ability to apply some of those coping mechanisms to try and help them.
Yeah.
And I know that I will be probably one of the most understanding parents because, in fact, I've married somebody with autism. Yeah. And also knowing that their father they can turn to and say, I don't understand, I don't get this. And you can one-on-one,
yeah.
autistic to autistic,
yeah.
talk.
Yeah. This has brewed another question. I'm sorry, we meant to go out one, but it's brewed. What is it that you recognise in me, my struggles, that make you so scared for them to be applied to our children?
I think a lot of it is the declining of mental health that is attached to it.
Yeah.
Because you've got autism and you've got mental health, and a lot of people feel that they are two separate entities.
Mm.
But I think the thing is a lot of the autism in you is then translated into a lot of your mental health problems.
Yeah.
I think also there is a certain element that I would never want my child to go through what you've had to go through with supported housing,
mm-hmm.
with dealing with people that don't understand you. I mean, I don't think that would ever have to happen.
Hopefully not. But, yeah.
But my point is they're the struggles, and the struggles where you do have moments where you feel that you're not understood by anyone,
mm.
and that people judge you, and they say things about you, and kind of the need to almost justify yourself.
Yeah.
Nobody,
which is always...
Nobody deserves that, though.
Yeah.
Nobody deserves to have to justify themselves. You should just be you.
And then when I do, I'm then ostracised and alienated and belittled because I've shared...
But this is the thing. No matter how much we try and say that discrimination is declining, you know, the amount of discrimination is decreasing, there will always be a stigma around any form of condition, disorder, or whatever else you
ethnicity,
want to call it.
Culture.
Exactly. There will always be derogatory terms and discrimination, whether you like it or not. And for somebody who, yes, grew up as non-autistic, yet still managed to get themselves bullied every day at school, yeah. I don't want that for my child.
Yeah.
You know, as it is, just being normal in quotation marks,
yeah.
that's bad enough.
Yeah,
you
know?
And I don't mean that as, oh, you're autistic so that you're different.
No,
but what I'm saying
is... The thing is that fear of... I had it as a child myself. I don't want to be known as autistic because it's hard enough.
Yeah, it's
under
hard
this
enough
guise,
just being human.
Yeah, under this guise of I'm normal, then being labelled as autistic or special.
It's even worse.
It is, isn't
it's
it?
It's literally like one brick on one shoulder and then they just put, oh, bloody house
yeah,
on top of you.
Yeah, yeah.
I think this is the thing. I got bullied for being fat. No matter how, I lost a lot of weight, but they still saw me as heffalump.
Known as,
why?
Yeah.
Because they saw me when I was fat and they can't see me any other way.
Same
if
as
you've
me.
Got a mole on your face, you're going to be bullied
for
it.
Got a spot on your head, you're spotty head.
Exactly. If you wear glasses, your four eyes. If you've got big feet, well, guess what? Here comes the clown. Mm. If you've got ginger hair, you're soulless. It, even when you are, in quotation marks, normal, you are almost guaranteed to be bullied for something. Or be the bully. Okay? If you've then got autism, it's just like, fuck, can this kid not catch a break?
Yeah.
And that's the thing. I know a lot of children are getting bullied for different things. I can almost guarantee our children will get bullied. Do you want to know why? It's purely because we will raise them in a way that no other child will be raised nowadays.
Mm.
And that is because we both have relatively old-fashioned values.
Mm-hmm.
We are both very intelligent. And here comes the four eyes, you know, teacher's pet, smarty pants. All that kind of stuff that comes from a really, really young age. And actually, it's just like, that kid's going to have enough to deal with.
Oh, no, now.
For autism to then be put on them, whether it happens or not, we can't do anything about it. But it's just an added thing. That
unless
just,
the added pressures of the societal rules and regularities and the imposed rules that you're meant to abide by socially... And also, I'm going to say this: there's when it comes to invisible illnesses or invisible conditions, there is no help.
No.
And then what annoys me is people, and I've learnt this from dealing with housing people. Laura has been there with me because I need Laura there when it comes to informational stuff and these procedural things. I can't do it. I can't. It one ear out the other. If it ain't a fucking experimental book or a Blu-ray, I'm not interested. I'm not going to process it.
No.
So I'm lucky in the sense that I have Laura with that. But what I still recognise is the people who are in this position who are meant to help me, to find me housing, turn around and go, isn't there anything for autistic people? No, there isn't. There's charities run by volunteers, but it's a meet-up to have a cake. Also, there's one end where you have high-functioning, low-functioning. High-functioning people don't want to be seen with the low-functioning people because there is a huge gap.
It's and like also, you can't communicate with them.
No, and it's like putting what people do, putting, they did this to me. They, because of the way I coped and behaved, they put me in the D37, which was the room for the naughty children.
Not the isolation room.
The isolation room, they put me in because I was a naughty, difficult child. Or I was a spastic. They didn't do anything with you. They just let you get on with what you wanted to do and you weren't progressing. There were a few teachers there who acted the way general teachers should. Mr. Plass there, who encouraged me my writing. Mr. Bradley, who was an assistant to a very, very autistic boy called Adam. And the archetypal... doing noises, flicking his ears, talking to himself. The voice... And spending a few time with Mr. Bradley, he knew how the autistic mind worked. He sat down with me and he said, oh, we're going to do some maths. Whereas if I went into D37, just go on the computer, Zach, just do what you want and try not to argue with that kid who's staring you out in the corner and don't fight him. He sat me down and he went, I want to do some maths with you. I want to do some learning with you. And I'm like, I don't want to. I hate maths. Maths is not my thing. Because one person... told me I was wrong one day and it was my relationship with maths was destroyed. And he sat down and he went, and he knew I loved films and he was a big film viewer himself, and he plied me with VHS's, and he recognised that in me and he went, we're going to take loads of budgets of these films, he said, and we're going to break down and I'm going to try and teach you how to calculate. But he took my interest that he knew
and applied it to something that you don't like in order to help you to like it.
And that's that one lesson with him. I love maths, but because he wasn't assigned to me, I never could see him or spend time with him. Also, you wouldn't want someone to be assigned to you in a mainstream running school because then you're even more ostracised. The difference with Adam was he was so very smart boy, really smart, high A stars, social abilities of a two-year-old. He dribbles, he snots in his own hands and eats it in front of you. Brain of Einstein. Mention a date, knows the history, knows the background, throw it all out to you. He hasn't got the awareness of all his autistic traits, his autistic self. He is all in his own head. And I sometimes feel jealous of that luxury. I also sometimes don't like the notion of being mixed in with people like that because you are stigmatised. The same with, if I ever went on a dating show before I met you, like the Undateables. If I went on that show, they would not pair me up with
a non-autistic person.
They would pair me up with someone who is veering near brain damage, Down syndrome, or really high on the autistic spectrum. And there is such
a difference between each and every autistic person.
And they don't work on that principle. And through these motions of different people, this notion of, well, there is something out there for you, isn't there? There's got to be. You're just being difficult. It's not just about being difficult. I have tried to go to these corporations. They're underfunded. People who work there are volunteers.
Is the cake shit?
I never got the cake because every time I turned up, it was people in wheelchairs, dribbling, uncommunicative, being fed. And I said, so the nurse practitioner who diagnosed me turned around and went, you're not trying hard enough. Nice. You want me to communicate with someone who's not aware that they can't communicate. And it's different. There's no recognition here. And when I turned from my nurse practitioner who diagnosed me, who got my name wrong in my folder 10 times, got my history backwards, got obsessed with me playing with wheels as a child, 40 pages worth about me as a two-year-old playing with wheels. No actual concrete evidence to apply to what I struggle with now. This is a man in a position who is meant to make my life a little bit easier by giving me my diagnosis, and he's focusing on all the wrong things. These people don't know how to diagnose. They don't know how to recognise. And those people who do, like Mr. Plass or like Mr. Bradley. They assigned certain people. I'm not saying that Mr. Bradley shouldn't have worked with Adam. He was great with Adam. But I mean people who have that willingness and that empathy and that understanding are never in the position that can benefit you. I mean, I sit here now and go, if a teacher, instead of looking at my address or what background I had or how I behaved previously or how I carried myself across, if one teacher just sat me down and said, Zach, don't look at this like doing an essay, look at it like doing a movie review, I'm not going to lie, I think I would have passed everything with an A star. I'm not going to lie, I think I would have. But because not one teacher wanted to communicate with me, you're Bryony Ferguson's little brother, nah, she's trouble, you're trouble. Oh, you're not trouble, you're just difficult. No, you're not just difficult, you're just fucking dumb. You haven't got a diagnosis, you're just difficult. And then, when I did my media A levels, Mr. Fouracre said, I believe that you can do A star. And you can get two GCSEs out of this. But because I was failing at everything else, I thought, heading for that A star, I knew I could do it. I thought, no, you stay where you know that. So I did a foundation paper, I passed with a C. And Mr. Fouracre came up to me, he went, well done, Zach, but you could have done that A star. And he looked at me as if to say, I don't know if it's laziness. And it wasn't. It was.
Easy.
It's easy. If I've been told that I can't, I'm an underachiever. I've been a teacher actually shows.
Sit in that group.
A teacher showed me, like my teacher said to me, imbued me with a confidence of I believe you can get an A star. My head was like, no, you can't. Do foundation, because you probably won't even pass that. And that dawned on me the other day, and I felt like crying, because no matter what. I left school with no GCSEs. I would at least have those two A stars and something that I was good at. But this is the issue still. If I went to Lewis College and I had A stars in media, I would still be put in that BTEC class because I haven't got a C in maths. And that has always been a great frustration for me. Also, you have to be in this BTEC class for at least 3 years before we will even contemplate putting you in the higher classes. It is difficult. It is, and it's not understood and it's not voiced. But anyway,
there's one more thing that I just wanted to say about my concerns about, you know, children and the possible autism diagnosis, and that's being taken advantage of.
Yeah,
something that worries me.
And it has happened
more
to me.
So, yeah, but I mean, it worries me more so with the lower functioning, but it's still possible with the higher functioning.
Oh, yeah. Shall I tell a story after you finish that will sum that up?
And I think it does. It just worries me because it is incredibly easy. It's not something that I would be capable of personally because my mind doesn't work that way.
Yeah.
But there are many people out there that it would be incredibly easy to take advantage with somebody with autism, low functioning or high functioning. And it happens every day in some of the most awful ways and in less awful ways, in different ways.
Like was that story my mum told us about someone with autism who got taken advantage with, and she was under the belief that they were friends
And that's the thing, that's the sort of thing that worries
that nearly,
me.
That nearly happened to me.
Yeah.
I got led to a drugs den.
But it's one of those things that it would concern me, and you worry about a child every day.
Yeah.
I think it would worry me two times, three times, four times more.
Well, even at the age of 17, I didn't know any better.
But that's what I mean, is that I'm not sure necessarily with somebody with autism or any other form of disorder in that sense. I don't think it matters how old you are still vulnerable.
Yeah.
And it worries me to have to truly worry about my child until my dying day. And quite frankly, who's going to look after them after that?
No.
And do you see what I mean?
Well, that's the greatest fear for myself. As much as strong and powerful as our relationship is, my greatest fear, and I had this today looking at my nan and granddad, I know it doesn't say, it sounds awful about my mum, but my mum's in a place of vulnerability herself with her own relationship with a very nasty man. And I don't see my mum as a lean-to or a power structure in any way. I can rely on her in certain things. But I was thinking, looking at my nan and granddad, and I went, when you two go, and if I didn't have Laura, I'm fucked.
Don't worry, you'll die before me now.
And it's scary, but it's that fear as well, and I understand tapping into that, but I want to give this quick story that really lends weight to what you're saying about that. College. First year, the only year, probably didn't even do a year. I was out pacing as usual, couldn't keep still. I saw a man out in the centre of town, covered in chalk, beautiful piece of art in the centre of Eastbourne town, and I went, oh my god, that is amazing. I saw this man. He gave me spiel about how he's an artist, but he's on hard, he's finding it hard not make ends meet. You know why I think I was attracted to the man, generally? I wanted to make a documentary about someone who was artistic, and I like the idea of being redemptive through art. I like the idea of a tortured artist, and this just fit the bill in my head. And I wanted a subject for a documentary, but I also recognised something. He looked like my dad. He looked like my dad, and my dad was a heroin addict. He had been homeless, and I just saw something in the man. And maybe that's why as well, but also my own ideals. And though loads of shady people were coming backwards and forwards, I naturally assumed he's on the street, he's also going to be associated with these people. So, I've gone home. I've got loads of cigarettes from my mum's pack. I've got him a drink. I put it in a flask. Go there. He's telling me about how he can do me a canvas, a portrait. All of a sudden, and it's only in hindsight that I recognise this, but he started talking to me like I was a friend, a confidant. And he was like, yeah, hang with me for a bit, kid. I told him about my interest in documentaries and all that and wanting to do one about him. And he'd be a great subject matter, but I didn't want to be offensive. And he was like, yeah, yeah. He took off this big puffer jacket and put it on me and zipped it up. Like, yeah, you're right there, mate. Yeah, yeah. I don't want you to be cold. And I was like, oh, this is nice. He's just trying to be companionable. Whilst in my autistic brain, I'm going, oh, it's dirty, it's dirty. Police arrive. Pull up in front of him. Another shady man's coming backwards and forward. And this man gave a false name. Can't remember what it is now. I think it was a hippy-dippy name that suits the type of art that was done on the streets. Turns out the guy who actually did the art was a hippie. And he was a busker type, not a heroin addict. So I eventually found out later down the line through Prince's Trust. Not surprising. Okay, I need to go through this. This is with the whole broad context I now have. He put that puffer jacket on me because he wanted to make me look like I was one of them when the police came along so they wouldn't question him. I thought he was being my friend. And as the police arrived, he pushed me aside, basically to say, don't get involved. The police told him to get out from the centre of town. You're not allowed in here. I thought, with my mind, they were telling him he wasn't allowed to do art. So he comes back and gives me spiel about this, saying I shouldn't be doing art here. I shouldn't be kipping here. And I mean, this guy's covered in chalk. So he said, me and my mate are going to where we're currently living. We're sleeping. Go to a corner shop. The guy buys me an energy drink in confidence. We break into a quarantined council estate. Go over a wall. Go through barbed wire. Go to this place where they've set up shop. Shut the door. Lock it. Start lighting candles. And it looks like any old home that they've made. It's torn up. It's rough. It's like something from a nuclear movie, like something's exploded, but you're trying to make the most out of what you've got. Again, in my head, I'm going, oh, real, like, street artist, like, that. He had books, and he had Blu-rays, and not Blu-rays, DVDs and all that. Well, it was later to find out, actually, that was just the remnants of all the stuff that was left there. This wasn't his home. Mm. It was a squat. It was a dump. Mm. They start cooking up heroin in front of me. And that's when alarm bells rang. Finally, all this time, I was happy to go along with it. Start cooking up. I was aware of it, not because I was ever exposed to it with my dad, luckily enough, but because films, paraphernalia. I turned around and went, I've got to go. And I'm really happy. And then the guy looked at me, and I'm not going to lie, it looked like that he was going to argue. It looked like he wanted to try and compel me to take some with him. Because there's one thing about certain junkies, they like creating more junkies because then there's other people. But he still gave me the gift of the gab. He went, I'm so sorry, I don't want you to think less of me because of this. Still playing up to that archetype of being a tortured artist. I said, I'll meet up with you in town tomorrow. I said, if you want some lunch, I'll get you some lunch. Went home, and by the time I got home, it was 2 a.m. and Mum's gone, what are you doing? I had to shower because I felt filthy, I felt dirty. And Mum said, where did you go? I said, I've just been to a drugs den, I think. She went, what? I went, no, you've got to give him a chance, Mum. We've got to give him a chance. I said, he does amazing work. I said, he said, if you give him some money, 20 quid, for a canvas, he'll do you one. Anyway, go then the next day, Mum's looking for him. Because I went somewhere else, I didn't go personally. So I was really pushing this onto my mum. Mum said, I don't think he is the artist. She went, what does he look like? I described him. She went, no, he's a skinny hippie who does it. Anyway, Mum goes out there, gives him a coffee, gives him a sandwich, and he takes it off her, and apparently just starts pulling the sandwich apart, as if to say, I don't like this, this ain't good enough. And Mum said to him, oh, my son said that you're an artist. He's like, yeah, I am. And then she said, all of a sudden, when she turned around, he just legged it, disappeared. She came back and she went, Zach, I think he's a tramp. She went, I think he's just wrong. So she was like, isn't it a sign enough that he took you to a drugs den? And she was like, oh my God, Zach, you're so naive. Did the princes trust? And then we had to volunteer at a local church, you know, down there. Where it's notorious for junkies and sex workers that go there for free. I saw him. I saw the man that I hadn't seen for 2 years, and I turned to the man who ran it. I went, who is he? He went, that's Brian. He went, oh, well, Brian. I went, he told me he was a street artist. He went, Brian? He went, he ain't got no talent. He said, he ain't got no talent, not even to the bottoms of his little finger. He went, he's a spinster. He's a liar. He'd do anything for what he wants. I said, well, he told me that he could do some art. And even though I recognised by my mum explaining these are wrong and it all came together, finally, it all summarised, the hindsight hit me. He went to that chalk drawing, covered himself in the hope to take advantage of a fucking person like me. And lo and behold, I came by. I was willing to feed this man and help this man, ply him with cigarettes, give him the time of day. And it was a lie. Gave me a fake name. He went, that's Brian. I told the guy who ran this place my story. He laughed at me and went, that's our Brian.
Brilliant, though.
So that shows you the naivety.
It does.
Also, my first experience of smoking a joint on my own, this kid was just like, yeah, it's just soft shit. Like, but
your first and last experience.
Pretty much, yeah. He made out it was like some big man drug dealer. And like that. He downplayed it and I was thinking, oh, all right then. And basically, was like, oh, I've got to leave you with my whole joint that I used a whole baggie on. And that's, again, taking advantage. Though I don't think the young kid really recognised that he was taking advantage, I still think it's the connotations of, I should have known better. Because after that, it was such a horrible experience. I kept telling everyone at college, I think he mixed it. I thought he spiced it. I think he's mixed it with something. And I came up to him eventually. He went, no, I just used the whole bag, mate. And that's the naivety that, sadly, I have. I think I've grown better. But in a lot of senses, I haven't. Because there's a lot of people in the indie community who have mistreated me. And have taken advantage of me. There's one young man, won't mention his name, who's a very paranoid individual himself, but I'm putting myself out on the line wanting to pay for his art, thinking it would be good for my book. I mean, in the breakdown of my relationship with another press or so, he then denied me having access to the images I paid for on my behalf, but he was under the influence that it was for the press. So I reacted as I do, like a petulant 12-year-old, give me my fucking images now, la 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 la. And then, in hindsight, I realised, shit, that was not the best way to handle this. And you grow from this and you learn from this. But people like him take advantage because he knew from the beginning. I was very candid with him. I don't have much money, but what I'm giving to you, I'm going to give to you. And he would always be like, oh, I'm really dependent on this money. Oh, I need it for my kid. And then he would go online and show all these different music festivals and events, which I've obviously paid for, or that he's going to. And then whilst also trying to make out that I'm a wrong'un, trying to do something with his images against his will when I paid for it. You know what I'm getting at here. It's not just to do with independent presses. In so many ways, that naivety is always translated. And it does take effect in so many aspects of my life. Luckily enough, I have matured beyond this point now. But I'm not going to say, oh, I won't lapse into some form of naivety, but who knows?
hopefully, though, that you're in a position now where you feel that relationship-wise, you don't feel that you could be taken advantage of in that sense.
Well, exactly. You're actually someone who hasn't got alternative agendas. Like, I had a certain friendship in the past, and it was all just take, use me as a scapegoat, take advantage of it. But when I apply the explanation to how my behaviour may have been conceived in the past, that person in question was, along with the masses, ridiculing me and calling me a liar. But anyway,
I think at this point we should say this is the end of part one.
This is the end of part one, because last time
I was cut off mid-sentence.
Yeah.
Which I really don't like.
No, DB.
So I think this is the end of part one, and we will begin the start of part two in 5, 4, 3, 2.
Apologies to Laura about cutting her off in the last episode. Very sorry about that, Laura. I did not mean to. And you can join us for the next episode, which should be in your feed right now. So if you want to listen to that, it's available. Here we go.